Hey, good day, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Excited to see my guys. Excited to talk to everybody today. Thanks again, as always, for tuning in, and thanks always for supporting the Roundtable. We get some amazing feedback from people who are watching these on a weekly basis, and some of the tidbits that we like to bring to the table are tidbits that we're hoping that you're able to use in your day-to-day work in the SIU world. Today, we want to talk about some really cool stuff. I've got, obviously, the whole team is here. Matt Kachansky, retired executive leader from HHS OIG, then Northeast UPIC director, and now senior manager on our SIU team. Jason Eisengrein, Matt's counterpart from HHS OIG, retired Western UPIC director, and our special director in charge of some of our special projects. And then Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office, and now a member of our SIU investigative team. So today we're going to talk about audits versus investigations. And I know we talk a lot about this on prior podcasts. We've explored this a number of times, but we want to talk a little bit more, get into a little bit of the weeds, talk about it from a due process perspective, standard of proof, consistency in the operation, the order of operations, and having good, strong policies that are out there, and that there may be some differences between audits and investigations, but we'll kind of morph into that conversation. Number one, and the first thing, and I want to start with you, Wade, is because, you know, at the OIG, we have something known as the Office of Investigations Policy and Procedure Manual, the OIPPM. It was known as, right, it's the Bible, if you're a religious person, but it is, you know, it was the standard manual of operations. It was what to do, when to do, and how to do it. And obviously, it's not going to address every single thing, and you don't need to have it all memorized, but you obviously needed to have some sort of working knowledge of the OIPPM so that you'd be able to know where to go when it comes to direction, because it did have things in there like the standard format for certain types of letters or correspondence or case updates. It had timelines when you write an interview report relative to the interview and things of that sort. So let's start, Wade, from just the perspective, because it really doesn't matter if you're an OIG agent, if you're an SIU investigator, if you're an analyst, whatever it is, it's going to have that consistency. But more importantly, it's going to help with credibility when we're talking about that standard of proof. And for me, one of the most important things is that that consistency has to cross investigator to investigator within the business line, right? So, you know, if you've got an interview that you do and you take notes and you don't write it up for 3 or 4 weeks, it's going to come and bite you back later when you have to make a presentation to a Mufugu lawyer, a referral to law enforcement, a regulatory body, even within the operation of the organization, right? So that consistency works to really lend itself towards credibility. It lends itself towards professionalism, and it also helps with being able to articulate what your facts are, right?
Yeah, and I mean, there's a couple things go into the OIPPM and how that's kind of like a roadmap and more of a workflow. But because you touched on the interview, I want to address that first. And it's even like you say, you have to do, you don't want to wait 2 or 3 weeks to write up your interview after you've taken your notes. I was a big proponent of, I want it written up, at least a very rough draft. You can worry about grammar and stuff later, but kind of expand your notes within a day or two, because you just, in my opinion, you just lose so much. If it's a week later, you've done other interviews, you're going to get things confused. So within, like, I think it's a good practice, and this is not in the OIPPM, but I think if you at least do a rough draft in 24 to 48 hours, and if you have to go back and dress it up later, that's fine. But again, going back to the OIPPM or a like document, if you look at it like a roadmap with the end of the investigation in sight and know what you have to complete along the different stages there, you're not going to get in a position where, oh, I should have gone back and I should have interviewed this person, or I should have wrote those interviews up, you know, 3 weeks ago. So you look at the end of the, not only the end of the investigation, but the different stages where you're going to present it to a prosecutor. You might bring on another agency. Say you find out that there's more exposure to Medicaid, you might bring in a Medicaid agent. So if you have that stuff that you've done well documented, and I would argue like over documented, you're going to be in a better spot. Now, one of the things that I came across in some working with some MCO organizations, And I get the reasoning for this, but I think it's misinterpreted when they're talking about using a minimum necessary approach. There are certain things where, like, if you're doing a record request or something, they don't need, you know, all the claim lines and everything. They just need maybe a member name, a date of birth, and things of that nature. But when you're documenting a file, you have to go, I think, to the opposite extreme, where it's like maximum necessary, because you don't know everything, that every piece of information that you come across that you're going to need later, or you won't. A lot of it you may not need, but it all has to be documented. Even in interviews, there's things that you think maybe aren't that relevant, include it, because something might come up later and you didn't include it in your interview, and now you're thinking, oh, I kind of remember about that, but I don't remember the details. So again, the opposite of minimum necessary when you're documenting your folder, going along that roadmap that's sent out by the program manual.
Yeah, that's an important point. So the Office Investigations, the Policy and Procedure Manual, says that reports need to be filed within 5 days of the interview taking place. And, you know, I'm saying that now there's going to be a bunch of defense attorneys, when they're doing their subpoenas, they're going to ask for copies of the procedure manual, and they're going to question agents on that. And I can tell you that I had something like that bite me during a trial. We had a post-arrest statement that was made by a defendant who was cooperating. And one of the agents that was with me took a copious amount of notes as part of the post-arrest, right? We do some training on when you've got two people doing an interview, the sort of that process. But safe to say that I was doing the interview, another agent was taking the notes. Well, the agent was going on vacation. And so I said, well, give me the notes and I'll write it up. And I wrote it up that night. So that wasn't the issue. But a year later, when the trial took place, my notes were turned over. The interview report was turned over. And depending upon how you read the notes, now it turned out to be a very, very benign thing that wasn't relevant to the admissions. But there was a statement that was in the notes that I interpreted one way, but could have been interpreted probably a number of other ways. And I wrote up my interview report on my interpretation of that note. And it led to 45 minutes of, or half an hour of cross-examination. And it really was benign. It was a nothing thing. It was, you know, a blue shirt, and I wrote, you know, powder blue or whatever, you know, something really benign. But the point is that, you know, at the end of the day, we're talking about interviewing and notes, the person that takes the notes writes up the report, but you've got to make sure that you're doing all of the things. That timeliness is really important, because that consistency in that operation. So, Matt, I want to go to you, because that's a phrase that you were using, consistency in operations.
Right.
And, you know, the position I think that, you know, we take when we do a lot of our training is that when you have a consistent way of doing something, it lessens the chance of the things that you're doing being found against you by an ALJ or a court, or just general scrutiny. Nothing worse than being deposed about something that you could have fixed along the way, right? We talk about consistency in operations. We talk about it when we talk about statistical sampling, probe sampling, interviewing, kind of the order of operations, and how that really needs to be a strong focus within an SIU from a policy and procedures perspective, but also from a practical application perspective.
Right, absolutely, yeah. You have to be consistent in how you do the things an investigator does. Every case is going to be different. Some are going to require interviews, some not. Some you're going to do an on-site, some you're not. But when you do those things, you have to do them the same way. Whether it's when you were looking at the allegation or looking at the data, what was the criteria that you used to open that case, so that you don't get into like a selective prosecution type of thing? You're consistent in the criteria you use to merit opening an investigation to begin with. When you're doing an interview, you are going to do all the interviews the same way, with at least two people, one taking the notes, that person writing it up. When you're doing an on-site, you're going to have a consistent checklist of things you're going to do in preparation for that checklist, and then in how that on-site is then conducted. They're all going to be different, but they're all going to follow the same path. So at the end, the results of those things, whether it's an admission from an interview or, you know, the on-site getting the medical records that show that the services weren't rendered, all of those things will be much more defensible when you can show that we followed the same way of doing these things, and they're based on whether it's a written policies and procedures manual or SOP, they're all there, and you can rely on those things to show you that you're doing the same things every time. Now, what you have to do to maintain that is to set up a quality assurance program where someone's going in, whether it's your team lead or a manager going in and doing follow reviews, making sure that your cases are documented well and that you are actually doing the things that according to the SOP, or you have someone, you know, do auditing of your cases after the fact to say all of these criteria are being met. You know, you've got an allegation that's clearly stated. You articulated well why you were opening it. It's in line with the criteria that you've used in other like matters. You've got your interviews documented, and you have this quality assurance program that makes sure that the consistency in operations is maintained.
So Jason, that then brings me to you, because right, consistency in operations also means that your policies and procedures are updated. And I guess I would think in terms of policies and procedures, I would think an equal discussion would be about when we're talking about providers and having an effective compliance program, that an effective compliance program is a living, breathing document, right? In the sense that we don't create it, we don't put it on a shelf and then revisit it in 5 years. We revisit it on a frequent and recurring basis because things change, right? The landscape changes. And so technology issues come into play, things of that sort. Now, you've done a lot of work for us here on policy related things, process improvement, and helping to set those standards. So let's talk a little bit about some of the things that you expect to see in a policy and procedure manual so that you've got that operational consistency, so that when you have to do things like your standards of proof or due process, for example, making sure that the policies are in line with being able to articulate, you know, we got to this point because, right? It's all got to be laid out in the manuals.
Exactly. I mean, frankly, you've said it all in terms of what you need to do to have a quality investigation or audit. And it's really about getting it documented, having your key process timeframes delineated in the your policies and procedures so that the staff knows what are the expectations. And to Matt's point, having templates as much as possible would help eliminate gaps in coverage of key points. But it also, it's really going to depend on what you want out of the effort that your unit is expending. So, you know, in the world of the Office of Investigations for OIG, we really had one work product that we performed, right? We did investigations. Now, they could be criminal, civil, or administrative, and those require different levels of proof, and commensurate with different levels of proof would be different, you know, methodologies, different documentation, different processes that are going to occur. So, you know, you got to start with case management. And if you throw into the mix, I mean, we did start out by saying this is, you know, audits and investigations. So, you know, frankly, I learned a lot after leaving OIG and taking on the role of program director for Medicaid integrity contracts in 35 jurisdictions. And, you know, those were all about audits. And you quickly learn about generally accepted government auditing standards and the things that are required to meet those are pretty rigorous. And so, you know, getting not too far afield, but the steps are going to be different in a GAGIS audit versus an investigation that's leading to a referral, unless it's an investigation leading to an administrative recovery. So again, it's about, you know, an understanding of what's in the best interest of the organization and its mission, and then keeping the investigators on track to producing the quality outcome. One other quick thing I'll add is, even down to writing those very important interviews, you know, some people want to write a narrative that goes on and definitely can't have personal opinions in it and things of that nature. But really, like it's written like a story as opposed to a substantive report of the information that you garnered from whatever as your observations, your interview, whatever it is. So getting, you know, a common methodology to produce reports would really assist in having that consistency of operation. So I add that as a pitch. That's really a whole discussion in of itself. And frankly, I think that advice could really provide some excellent report writing training if that's of interest to anyone.
Yeah, and you know, just to kind of take it back to the OIG, when we were all there, we went through 3 days of training on, you know, writing reports and kind of just different ways to format them and do that. You know, there's always going to have to be a need for a level of literary freedom, so to speak, right, where you can kind of write it as you see. But, you know, getting back to Wade's point, which is this minimum necessary versus completeness, I think, you know, one of the important things, at least from an evidence tracking perspective, and Wade, I'll give you the last word on this, is if you're going to make a request of X number of records, you've got to document how did you come up with two things, the number of records to select and the records themselves, right? So I recently had a conversation with one of our SIU clients that we do some work for, and the investigator sent over 7 records. And my first question was, I'm not questioning you about any of this, but are you documenting in your case file, why did you pick these 7 versus 7 others, 10, 20, 30? The decision is yours, but you've got to document that, because at the end of the day, someone may ask that question, right? So sometimes that the minimum necessary should be in some things, but the over documenting should be in others, right?
Right. And in addition to documenting, you know, how you came about picking these 7 records, or I think equally as important is that the reason that you came up with this number is consistent. It wasn't just because, oh, these were the first 7 on a page and I only wanted to keep it minimum, or if it was these are the 7 highest billed or the highest paid. It could be based on a number of different reasons, but those reasons need to be consistent throughout the organization, and they need to be documented. So again, a defense attorney is not going to come in and have you on the stand for an hour as to why you picked these 7. You can just say, well, in our manual, it's based on, you know, X, Y, and Z. And that's the method everybody is using, and it's documented that way. So that's probably equally as important as documenting how you came up with it is why you did, based on something in a manual that you're basically following the regulations and the rules.
Right. And we talk a lot when we do our training on sampling. We talk a lot about statistical sampling, probe sampling, and then just some other version of random sampling that's not probe, right? So taking the top 7 build or whatever it may be is going to be something other than a probe and other than a statistical, but there should be some methodology behind that, right? If this investigator is pulling 7 or other investigators pulling 7 on their non-statistical or non-probe, right? You want to be able to articulate. And even if they're not, it's fine, right? So I think what we don't want to say is we don't want anybody to feel pigeonholed in their selection process, just that if you're going to pull some number that's not a statistical sample, probe sample that's based upon some methodology like following the CMS PIM, where, you know, it's 20 to 40 and we always say 30 for consistency. If you're taking the number other than a statistical sample, other than 30 as a probe, why are you picking only these? So, right, it's just part of that evolution. This isn't something that necessarily needs to be in a manual, but there certainly needs to be articulation for consistency in operations, right? And that all lends itself to having that positive professional culture that SIUs, you know, strive to achieve. So, yeah, great stuff. We could talk about each one of these topics. I think we could probably spend an entire podcast talking about each one of these issues, whether it be how to document the sampling methodologies and all that. So there's always a ton to be out there. But number one is you've got to have these things in some sort of policy. It can't just be on a napkin written in your desk drawer, right? It's got to be something that everybody is kind of in agreement with. So, as always, good information for me, at least. Good seeing you guys again. Thanks everybody for participating in the weekly podcast. Again, you can get us in your inbox every Friday. Hello at advise, advizehealth.com. Please go to our website, advisehealth.com. Check out our new refreshed website. When you get up onto that website, one of the first things that pops up on the splash screen is the ability to sign up for our newsletter. So you can even go without sending us an email to hello. You can get right up to the website and sign up to subscribe to our newsletter from there. Refreshed webpage, a lot of great content. We have our own page now. The OIG podcast is there. So feel free to do that. We've got a great LinkedIn Live coming up in May. We're going to be talking about behavioral health fraud from two sides. I'll be moderating a great talk with one of our behavioral health investigators and our behavioral health auditor on conducting behavioral health investigations from the coding and documentation perspective, as well as from the investigative perspective. So I'm looking forward to that. And thanks everybody for tuning in to the podcast that we did a few weeks ago, or the LinkedIn Live we did a few weeks ago on the case of US v. Paulus. It was one of our most highly attended podcasts that we did, LinkedIn Lives rather, that we did. So thanks again for that. And as always, we love hearing your feedback. So feel free to let us know on other podcasts or LinkedIn Lives that we can do. And in the meantime, we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable.